Welcome to Then and Now with Ed Stevens, President of the International Preterist Association. Then and Now is a weekly podcast designed to explore past fulfillment of Bible prophecy in order to equip us for guiding the church in its ongoing reform. And now, with today's message, here's Ed Stevens.
Thank you for joining us here on Then and Now for another look at first century history. Let's pray before we get into our studies. Glorious Lord, creator and sustainer of the universe, we praise you for all you have done to save us and make us your useful servants. Be with us now as we look at your sovereign and providential work in history. May we learn from your example how to be holy, righteous, and godly in the midst of this dark world, so that our good example will light up the pathway for others to more easily follow you. It is in the name of your Son and our Savior Jesus that we pray. Amen. Before I begin, I want to let our new listeners know that there is a lesson outline available for each of these podcasts. Many of our listeners like to have it open in front of them as they listen. If you'd like to have it, simply email me and request it. If you would like to be on the list to receive each new lesson outline as soon as it's ready to go, without having to request it each time, simply email me and ask to be put on the PDF list. It's free for the asking, so email me at preterist1@preterist.org. Thanks to all of you who are emailing your questions and comments. I am so glad you're listening and that you're carefully considering what we are saying here. If there's anything you do not understand, do not hesitate to email me. Last time we put the finishing touches on all the material that we covered in the previous three podcasts regarding the seven churches of Asia, how many saints were left alive on earth at the time of the Parousia, as well as where were all of those Christians after 70 AD and why they were no longer around. This session we will get back into the historical narrative. We have spent quite a bit of time covering the 2 years from 62 to 64. A lot was happening then. There were at least 12 books of our New Testament written during those 2 years, possibly more. The persecution was heating up. Missionary activity was intense. Paul was in and out of prison during that time. James was killed. John was exiled. There was a great falling away of many false brethren. And the Neronic persecution was just about to strike. We noted how intense that persecution really was. Jesus said that great tribulation would be so intense that unless it was cut short, none of the elect would have been saved. And Apostle John indicated in the Apocalypse that a great multitude of martyrs came out of that great tribulation, Revelation chapter 7, verses 9 through 17. According to Revelation 7, verse 9, this group of martyrs came from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues. Evidently, it was not just from the city of Rome. Evidently, there were martyrs from every nation in the diaspora where there were Christians. It seems that the majority of Christians must have either fallen away in the great apostasy or were killed in the Neronic persecution. But Jesus indicated that the elect ones would be preserved until the Parousia, at which time he would send forth his angels to gather together his elect. It appears that the Neronic persecution was the beginning of the end for Nero and the Jews. Things began to degenerate rapidly from here onwards. The storm clouds of God's judgment were looming on the horizon, not only for the Jews, but for the Romans as well. Nero and the Jews had poured out a great tribulation upon the church, and now it was their turn to reap what they had sown. The wrath was about to be poured out upon them. God was sending all kinds of warning signals in the heavens and on the earth that he was about to judge them for what they had done to his people. So we are beginning to see here, or about to see, that things are going to go badly from here onwards for Nero and the Jews after they had killed the Christians in AD 64. Here in March of 65 AD, while the Neronic persecution was still in progress, Josephus and others tell us that Nero assaulted his religious wife, Poppaea, and caused her death. Poppaea was pregnant, and Nero, in a fit of rage, assaulted her, allegedly kicked her in the midsection, causing the death of both her and her unborn child. This was the beginning of the end for the Jewish cause. Through the influence of Poppaea, the Jews had been able to win many benefits from Rome. But now Nero was no longer as sympathetic to the Jewish cause. This relationship of the Roman emperor married to a wife who was sympathetic to Judaism may have been in the mind of John when he penned the book of Revelation. The Jews probably used their influence with Poppaea to get Nero to kill the Christians. Was Poppaea a symbol of the harlot city, Jerusalem, who was drunk with the blood of the saints? This is another reason why I believe Paul was arrested and martyred before AD 65. The Jews had an ally in Nero up until the death of Poppaea. After she was killed, it is less likely that the Jews would have been able to use Roman power against the Christians. The tide was beginning to turn against the Jews. This may have been the beginning of the cutting short of the tribulation that Jesus mentioned in his Olivet Discourse, coupled with increasing unrest and rebellion in Judea, which provoked the Romans to withdraw their protection from the Jews and begin gathering their forces to crush the rebellion. The Jews no longer had the Romans as an ally, but instead as their adversary now, and were forced to drop their active campaign against the church and focus all their energies on preparation for the war. This would have cut short the persecution of the church. Josephus was supposedly still in Rome at this time, but he does not say anything about the persecution of Christians, nor about its being cut short later. Soon after Nero had killed his wife, Poppaea, there was a conspiracy raised against Nero to try to unseat him from the emperorship and replace him with another guy by the name of Piso. April of 65, just a few months after the Neronic persecution had started. So it's very interesting that even the Roman people want to get rid of Nero. When Nero discovered this conspiracy against him, he had many of Rome's leading citizens put to death. Warmington says a lot about this in his book on Nero, and we're going to read a little section here, three paragraphs from Warmington's book about this conspiracy. And he says, "The object of the conspiracy was the assassination of Nero and his replacement as emperor by the noble Calpurnius Piso. The motives of the conspirators were various, some quite trivial. Lucan is said to have joined the conspiracy because he had been forbidden to publish his books. Afranius Quintianus, because he had been insulted in a lampoon by Nero. Fannius Rufus joined the conspiracy because he feared the influence of his co-prefect, Tigellinus, who was a good friend of Nero's. The consul designate Plautius Laturnus and the courageous freedwoman Epicharis were moved by amor republicae, which is love of the republic, or in other words, patriotism, joining the conspiracy because they loved the republic and they saw Nero as an enemy of the people and an enemy of the republic. The participation of Fannius Rufus with three tribunes and three centurions of the Praetorian Guard had a double significance. No conspiracy had much chance of success without the support of the Praetorians. More important, officers of the guard were naturally chosen for reliability as well as efficiency. They came from Italian towns whose upper classes had a tradition of loyal service to the emperors and where senatorial pretensions were little regarded. Tacitus, in the Annals, chapter 15, sections 62 through 68, Tacitus attests the actual words of the tribune Subrius Flavus, one of the most active of the conspirators. When asked by Nero why he had broken his oath of fidelity to the emperor, he said, "I hated you, though no soldier was more loyal when you deserved our love. I began to hate you when you became the murderer of your mother and wife, and when you became a charioteer and an actor and an incendiary." That's the end of the quote from Warmington's book, pages 136 and 137. Notice that latter charge, incendiary, or fire starter. The tribune was putting his life on the line by making this kind of an accusation against Nero. He had nothing at all to gain by it and everything to lose. It was probably testimony like this against Nero which reignited the rumors that Nero had ordered the fires to be started in Rome the previous summer. It is amazing that after 8 months had passed and a scapegoat had already been punished for the fire, that a Roman tribune, notoriously loyal to the emperor, was found involved in a plot against Nero and claiming that part of the reason for his involvement in the plot was because Nero was an incendiary or fire starter. Nero wasted no time and spared no expense to cover his tracks and get rid of all the evidence against him. Blood flowed again in Rome. It is interesting that Apostle Paul had been in prison in Rome 2 years before this and had said in his letter to the church at Philippi just before his release that his imprisonment in the cause of Christ had become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else there in Rome, including Caesar's household. Philippians chapter 1, verse 13 and Philippians 4, verse 22. That would suggest that there were some Christians in the palace and in the military there in Rome. No wonder the tribune Subrius Flavus was mad at Nero for starting the fires in Rome. Some of his fellow soldiers may have been killed in the persecution that followed, if any of them were Christians who had heard Apostle Paul preach the gospel to them while they were guarding him there in prison at Rome. Very interesting connection there. Well, in the middle of 65 A.D., shortly after this conspiracy had arisen, it tells us that Nero even ordered his own top advisor, Seneca, well-known Roman statesman, like Secretary of State back in those days, who was Nero's tutor when he was younger. He became Nero's top advisor later on down the road. And evidently, Nero believed that Seneca was somehow involved in the Piso conspiracy against him, or at least somewhat sympathetic with some of the conspirators, so he ordered Seneca to kill himself. Well, meanwhile, back in Judea, tensions were building towards the outbreak of war. Gessius Florus was the new Roman procurator that had come just a few months earlier, and he was now there. And he looked the other way as the armed bands of zealots and bandits raided the cities and villages of Judea, unchecked by the Roman procurator, who should have stopped all of that activity. He let them plunder, hoping that it would inflame the populace to revolt. And it worked. Gessius Florus wanted the Jews to revolt so that he would have a good excuse for crushing them and destroying them and seizing all their property. The zealots became determined to revolt as a result of his actions, and they started gathering men and materials for a revolt. Josephus says that Gessius Florus encouraged the bandits and rebels to spoil the Judean cities and give him his share of the booty. This policy of looking the other way while Judean cities were being plundered by Jewish rebels became intolerable for the moderates and the loyalists. Armed groups of bandits terrorized the Judean countryside with no one to stop them during this spring and summer of AD 65, just a year before the war broke out. It was at this time, Josephus says, that many people deserted their ancestral homes and sought refuge in foreign provinces. Many others joined the zealot cause and started pushing for open revolt. The Christians had already left or been killed in the Neronic persecution. If any of them had fallen away back into Judaism, they would most likely have been under tremendous pressure at this time to join the Zealot rebellion. Josephus notes that many people in Judea left their homesteads, lands, and property and fled to foreign provinces at this very time. It was those armed bands of zealots and bandits which provoked many people to leave Judea at this time. These armed groups were running around all the cities throughout Judea. This would have been a great time for the Jewish people to get out of Judea before Florus brought his troops shortly afterward and killed 3,600 of them in Jerusalem. Well, this has raised a lot of questions in the minds of a lot of people in the past who didn't understand all this history and how it all fit together and was sequenced. Several have asked me whether this might have been the time when the Christians fled from Jerusalem and went to Pella and the other safe haven cities. They've also asked me why the Christians were commanded to flee from Judea if there was going to be a rapture shortly. So I want to read some of these questions that have been asked about this very time of history and then give a brief response to them. Question number one. Wouldn't this have been a good time for Christians to leave Judea? Yes, indeed it would, if there were any Christians still left there. However, as we have seen in past sessions, the Christians were warned in 62 or 63 to leave Judea before the Neronic persecution broke out in 64. If they had stayed in Judea, they would have been killed in the Neronic persecution and would not have remained alive until the Parousia and until the war broke out. This indeed would have been a good time for Christians to leave, but I don't think there was any of them left there. They had long gone before the Neronic persecution broke out. Question number two, why did Christ command them to flee from Judea if there was going to be a rapture? Well, my response to that is, he commanded them to flee from Judea because that would enable them to live and remain until the Parousia, at which time they would be able to be raptured. But if they had remained and stayed there in Judea, they would have been killed in the Neronic persecution and not been alive at the time of the Parousia and rapture. The reason so many of us ask this question is because we assume that the Christians fled to Pella just before the war began in AD 65 or 66. But such a late departure from Judea creates a real historical problem. The Christians needed to leave Palestine long before 65 or 66. They needed to leave in 63 or very early 64, before the Neronic persecution started. That is why both the book of Revelation and the book of Hebrews were written, to warn them to get out of Palestine before the Neronic persecution struck. This should be obvious to all of us, but because we have forgotten about the Neronic persecution or failed to sequence it properly in relation to the other end-time events, we have been thrown off track by this question. And so I think that'll help us when we remember that the Neronic persecution was the reason they needed to get out of Judea, and therefore they must have been warned ahead of time to get out before the Neronic persecution. Therefore, they would not have been there at the time of 65 and 66 AD. Any Christians who remained would have been killed in the Neronic persecution. So there's an easy explanation for why they were no longer around, and so they would not have been fleeing from Judea at this time when Josephus tells us the rest of the Jews were fleeing out of there at this time in 65 AD. Well, question number three. If there were very few believers who survived the Neronic persecution, what was the purpose of fleeing to Pella afterwards, especially if they were going to be raptured shortly? Well, this question presupposes a number of things. It presupposes that the Neronic persecution was over by this time, so that it was safe again for Christians to remain in Palestine. But that's a wrong assumption. any Christians who would have remained in Palestine and Judea during that Neronic persecution, which extended all the way up to the revolt, would have been killed. And so it was not safe for them to be there. And as we notice, they would have been warned even before the Neronic persecution to get out. And so there was no purpose in fleeing to Pella at 65 and 66 because there wouldn't have been any Christians in Judea left. They either killed in the persecution or had already fled before the Neronic persecution. That brings up another question. Then why even warn them at all to leave if there was going to be a rapture shortly? Well, I think we need to get a better idea of the sequence here of events. Of course, this question presupposes a sequence and timing of events that does not harmonize with the way these events actually happen. His assumed sequence of events is that the Neronic persecution killed most Christians, and the warning to flee came just before the siege of Jerusalem, and then the parousia and rapture occurred. And, of course, his dating for those events is 64 to 66 for the persecution, 66 to 68 for the warning to flee, and then the parousia and rapture occurred, according to him, in AD 70. But that's a wrong date and sequence of events, and we need to look at the correct sequence and date for these events. The reason why we preterists have arrived at such a wrong sequence and timing of events is because there are still some leftover futurist concepts floating around inside our heads. For example, many of us still think that the tribulation upon the church that is mentioned in Matthew 24 was referring to the suffering of the Jewish people under the siege in Jerusalem in 68, 69, and 70 AD. We don't realize that it was instead referring to the horrible afflictions the church suffered under the Neronic persecution before the war. And we also don't realize when the flight to Pella actually took place. We assume it was about the time the war broke out or after the war had broken out in Judea. But that would be forgetting the fact that the majority of the Christians had already been killed in the Neronic persecution. There were few, if any, Christians left in Judea by the time the war began in 66 AD. What would be the point of warning them to get out of Judea after most of them had already been killed in the Neronic persecution? That wouldn't be a very timely or helpful warning. They needed to be warned before the Neronic persecution, not afterwards. Furthermore, Josephus tells us that Essenes, Zealots, Pharisees, and Sadducees all participated in the war effort. But there is no mention of any Christians either staying and participating or trying to get out of the city. If there were any Christians still left in Judea and Jerusalem at the time of the war, we would have expected Josephus to mention their attempt to flee and get away from the city or their participation in the conflict on one side or the other. Yet there is no mention of them. They drop totally out of the historical narrative before the war began. Since most of the Christians died in the Neronic persecution during the 2 years before the war, it means that any warning to flee out of Judea at the beginning of the war would have been a little too late to be of any real benefit to the Christians. Therefore, the warning to flee must have been related to the Neronic persecution. This is a real game changer for most of us. Once we realize that Jesus was warning them about the Neronic persecution and not just about the siege of Jerusalem, it instantly clears up the confusion and resequences the events in a way that makes much more sense. Most of us, including myself, have been so historically handicapped from our futurist days that we miss this point. That is why I began digging deeply into this historical study 6 years ago. The one event that we have all overlooked is the Neronic persecution in AD 64. That is the 2,000-pound gorilla in the room. I missed it for a lot of years. Very few preterists are even aware of it as a factor in all this, much less understand where it fits into the overall sequence of events. Most of us have assumed that the Great Tribulation upon the church was during the siege of Jerusalem in 68 to 70 AD, and that the Neronic persecution was a part of that tribulation, which was still going on during the war until Nero died in 68 AD. Unfortunately, that idea simply does not harmonize with the Bible or with history, as we are about to see. Jesus said in Matthew 24 that unless those days of the Great Tribulation, which is the Neronic persecution, were cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect ones, those days were indeed cut short, so that there were still some elect ones, some faithful Christians on earth at the time of the parousia, when Christ sent forth his angels to gather those elect together. Now notice the sequence of events here in Matthew 24. Number one is the Great Tribulation, which would be cut short. And that's, of course, the tribulation upon the church, which is the Neronic persecution in 64 AD. The second thing that's listed in the sequence here in Matthew 24 is that immediately after that Great Tribulation was cut short, Christ would come in his parousia. And then the third event that's mentioned in that context is that he would send forth his angels to gather together the elect, which is the rapture. And so we've got this sequence mentioned in Matthew chapter 24. We've got the tribulation upon the church, the parousia, and then the rapture. Eusebius tells us that the Christians were warned by a revelation given to approved men before the war to flee out of Judea and Jerusalem. However, Eusebius does not tell us how long before the war this warning was given, but the peculiar wording of this statement suggests that the book of Revelation might have been the source of this warning. Furthermore, we have two such warnings by the apostles, who were indeed approved men, before the Neronic persecution broke out. The book of Revelation, written in late 62 AD, warned them to come out of her, my people, Revelation 18, verse 4. And the book of Hebrews, which was in circulation by early 63, also warned the Hebrew saints to go out to him outside the camp, because here we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the one which is about to come, speaking of the heavenly Jerusalem. Hebrews chapter 13, verses 13 and 14. Both of these warnings came to the church well over a year in advance of the Neronic persecution. That implies that the Neronic persecution was the Great Tribulation upon the church, about which the church needed to be forewarned. Those two apostolic warnings were the divine signal to the church, and the very signal that they were waiting for. If the church heeded those warnings and left Judea soon afterwards in 63 AD, they would have been out of harm's way long before the Neronic persecution reached Judea in the fall of 64 AD. That would have been a great benefit to those saints to have that kind of a warning so that they could get out of the country in time to be safe out of harm's way. However, it does not appear that the warning was heeded by the majority of Christians. Most of the Judean Christians evidently stayed and either fell away back into Judaism or were killed in the Neronic persecution. Evidently, only a small remnant of saints left at that time. We noted in past sessions that some of those who went to Pella were not true Christians. They were Judaizers who rejected the virgin birth and deity of Christ and were well known as Ebionites and Nazareans. Some of them may have been elect saints who lived and remained until the parousia in the summer of 66, at which time they would have been raptured, leaving nothing but Unitarian Judaizers there in Pella afterwards. We also need to remember that it was not just the Judean Christians who were at risk here in the Neronic persecution. It was all Christians throughout the empire, especially those Christians living in areas where there were large Jewish communities. When the Neronic persecution broke out, the Jews would have killed the Christians living among them. The seven churches of Asia would be a prime example of this very thing. Evidently, most of the seven churches addressed in Revelation ignored the warning to back away from their connections with the Jewish community and were totally devastated in the Neronic persecution which followed. This is not hard to believe, since Paul told Timothy in his second letter that all who were in Asia had turned away from him. AD 63 is when that occurred. This was after they had already been warned by the book of Revelation and the book of Hebrews. Evidently, they rejected those warnings and suffered the consequences shortly afterwards, either in the Neronic persecution or in the outbreak of the Jewish war. So here is the sequence of events that we are suggesting here. AD 62, the book of Revelation was written, warning the saints to come out of her. AD 63, the book of Hebrews was written, warning them to go out to him outside the camp. AD 63, the saints fled to Pella before the Neronic persecution. At least a small remnant of them did. AD 64, Neronic persecution killed all the Christians who stayed in Judea. And 2 years later, the Neronic persecution was cut short by the parousia and the outbreak of the war. In AD 66 also, the elect saints who fled to safety and remained alive were raptured at the parousia. And then, shortly after that, the war broke out. Notice again that they were warned to flee before the Neronic persecution, not afterwards, as suggested by the person who asked this question that we're responding to. Do you see how this resequencing of the warning solves the problem of a belated flight to Pella after most of them had already died in the Neronic persecution? The warning would not make much sense if it occurred after the Neronic persecution, as most of our fellow preterists and all of the futurists, of course, believe. The warning came before the Neronic persecution, and it was warning them to get out of Judea before the Neronic persecution struck, not just before the war and the siege of Jerusalem. That makes a big difference in how we understand Matthew 24 and its statements about the Great Tribulation and their fleeing from Judea. Well, let's look at some of the signs that were occurring in Judea and Jerusalem at this very time in April of 65 down to April of 66, just before the war broke out. In this year or so before the war, the historians tell us, Suetonius, I believe, and some others, tell us that there was a plague in Rome in which 30,000 of the Roman citizens died. And so we see a plague, or a pestilence, as the Bible refers to it, occurred in April of 65, just 1 year before the outbreak of the war. And 30,000 citizens in Rome died as a result of that plague that struck Rome in the spring of 65 AD. Afterwards, there was a powerful whirlwind or hurricane which destroyed crops and fruit trees over a wide area in Campania. Now, Campania is like a district that was south of Rome there in Italy. But here there's a plague in Rome in 65 AD, which killed 30,000 of the Roman citizens. There were other plagues and pestilences during this period from AD 30 to 70 that are mentioned in Josephus and Tacitus and Philostratus, as well as Seneca. Seneca mentions some plagues and pestilences during this very time, but they seem to be becoming more devastating and more frequent as we get closer to 66 AD. In the Harmony of the Gospels by McGarvey and Pendleton is called Fourfold Gospel. McGarvey and Pendleton comment on Luke 21, verse 11, which says that there would be some plagues and famines. And they say this, there were an indefinite number of famines referred to by Roman writers and at least one pestilence during which 30,000 perished in Rome alone in AD 65. All these signs are mentioned by unbelieving writers such as Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, Philostratus, and Seneca, who speak of them because of their importance and not with any reference to the prophecy of Christ. In fact, it seems that they were not even aware of these predictions of Christ. They just mentioned them because they were serious in their impact upon the Roman people. In Barnes' notes, in his commentary on Matthew chapter 24, verse 7, he says, a pestilence is recorded as raging in Babylonia in AD 40 and in Italy in AD 65, according to Tacitus chapter 16, section 13, and Josephus's account of it is in the Antiquities, book 18, chapter 9, section 8. Both of these took place before the destruction of Jerusalem, he says. That's Albert Barnes in his commentary on Matthew 24, verse 7. Well, in Luke 21, verse 11 and verses 25 and 26, Luke says that at this time of the end, when the end was drawing near, there would be terrors and great signs from heaven. And Josephus tells us in the wars, in several places, that are mentioned here in the notes, lesson outline notes. So if you get the lesson outline, you'll have these references from Josephus and Tacitus, and Sefer Yosipan also mentions some of these terrors and great signs from heaven that occurred in these months leading up to the outbreak of war. There was a star in the shape of a sword and a comet which stood above Jerusalem for a whole year before the war. And here is what Josephus said about the effect of these terrors and great signs upon the Jewish people in AD 66, just before the war began. He says, in all parts of the city, darts and all sorts of armor were upon the anvil. Although the multitude of the young men were engaged in exercises without any regularity, and all places were full of tumultuous doings, yet the moderate sort were exceedingly sad. And a great many there were who, out of the prospects they had of the calamities that were coming upon them, made great lamentations. There were also such omens observed as were understood to be forerunners of evils by such as loved peace, but were by those that kindled the war interpreted so as to suit their own inclinations. And the very state of the city, even before the Romans came against it, was that of a place doomed to destruction. Now that's Wars, Book 2. Section 649 through 650. In April of 65, as well, at this very time, 1 year before the revolt, there was a star in the shape of a sword and a comet, which stood above Jerusalem for a whole year up until the outbreak of the war. Josephus says, thus there was a star resembling a sword, which stood over the city, and a comet that continued a whole year. Now, Whiston, who translated that, made a comment in the footnotes about this sign that appeared. He says, whether Josephus means that this star was different from the comet, which lasted a whole year, I cannot certainly determine. His words most favor their being different from one another. In other words, Whiston thinks that there was both a star in the shape of a sword and a comet, which both stood above Jerusalem for a whole year up until the outbreak of the war. Well, in the week right before Passover of 66 AD, so we're getting down close to the outbreak of the war now, In the week before Passover, a bright light shined around the altar and the temple like daylight for half an hour. Josephus says, "Thus also, before the Jews' rebellion, and before those commotions which preceded the war, when the people were come in great crowds to the Feast of Unleavened Bread in AD 66, on the eighth day of the month Xanthicus, and at the ninth hour of the night." Notice Josephus gives us the day and the hour of this event. He says, "So great a light shone round the altar and the holy house that it appeared to be bright daytime, which light lasted for half an hour." Whiston comments on this. He says, "Since Josephus still uses the Syro-Macedonian month Xanthicus for the Jewish month Nisan, this eighth, or as Nicephorus reads it, this ninth of Xanthicus, was almost a week before the Passover on the 14th of the month, about which time we learn from St. John that many used to go out of the country to Jerusalem to purify themselves," John chapter 11, verse 55, and also John 12, verse 1. This is certainly in agreement with Josephus here as well. And it might well be, Whiston says, that in the sight of those folks who had come early, a week in advance, to purify themselves, that it was in the sight of those folks that this extraordinary light might appear. Very interesting comment there. And so he suggests that this bright light could very well have been seen by all those pilgrims who had come a week early to be purified in preparation for observing the Passover. Well, in that same month of April, in 66 AD, Josephus tells us that Passover in the temple, that a heifer gave birth to a lamb in the temple courtyard. Now, I'm sure most of us would laugh at this and ridicule it as not being a historical event. But again, we have to remember that these were priests in the temple who witnessed this event. Out of all the people in the Jewish world who would be most reliable as witnesses to testify about an event, the priest would have to be at the top of the list. And here they are giving their testimony that in the temple at Passover, a heifer, as she was led by the high priest to be sacrificed, brought forth a lamb in the midst of the temple. Now, how much better witness can you get than the high priest? So you can guarantee that Josephus didn't invent this story. He must have had some very reliable eyewitness testimony to back it up. And Josephus was a priest himself. It is highly unlikely that he would have recorded this event unless it really happened. At the time he wrote in 78 AD, there were still living some of his fellow priests who could easily have discredited this story. Yet as far as we know, no one ever disputed it. This event occurred at the Passover inside the temple in April of 66 AD. I have pondered over the significance of this event several times, but never could quite understand it, until I was preparing the notes for this lesson and suddenly remembered how my dad on the farm, when I was young, explained to me the difference between a heifer and a cow. He said, "A heifer is a young female who has not yet had a calf of her own and is under 3 years of age. It is a young girl cow who has never mated with a bull. In other words, a young virgin cow." Now, when I remembered that conversation with my dad on the farm, I suddenly understood the significance of this young virgin cow giving birth to a lamb. Mary was a young virgin who had never had a child of her own, who gave birth to the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Now, that may not be the explanation of this incredible event, but it certainly deserves our serious consideration. And what a testimony that would have been to the Jewish people at that very time when they were on the edge of going to war against Rome. What an amazing testimony to them about the truth of Christianity. I would like to have had Apostle Paul's perspective on that story. God was definitely trying to get their attention by this event. What was he trying to tell those Jewish people at that time? We may never know for sure, but the Virgin Mary and her little lamb, Jesus, makes an awful lot of sense. Any Jewish person familiar with the virgin birth of Jesus could have seen that connection and understood what God was trying to say to them on that occasion. It was at least an affirmation of the virgin birth of Jesus, if not a whole lot more, as we will see. Furthermore, note that the high priest who was leading this heifer away to be sacrificed was the grandson of the very high priest who had led Jesus away to be crucified 36 years earlier. His name was Matthias, son of Theophilus and grandson of Annas the First. This may shed some light on why this unusual birth of a lamb by a heifer in the temple occurred at this very time by this particular high priest. We have to wonder if God was sending a message not only to the whole Jewish people in general, but even more particularly to the family of Annas, showing them that he remembered what Annas had done to Jesus 36 years earlier and was about to bring them to judgment for it. Did Matthias catch the power of that? Or was he only thinking about the delicious feast his family would get from that beefy sacrifice? Or did he rub his chin and say, there is something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear, but it doesn't look good for me and my family. This is not a good sign. Did he remember any of the things that his grandfather, Annas, and Uncle Caiaphas had done to Jesus 36 years before? Did he realize that the blood of Jesus was imputed against that whole generation of Jews and his own family of Annas specifically? Notice what the following text have to say about this. And I'm reading from John chapter 11, verses 49 through 52, where it says, "But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish.'" Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. And then, of course, in John 18, verse 24, it says, "So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest." That's Annas the First, sent Jesus bound to Caiaphas, his son-in-law, who was high priest that year. Mark chapter 15, verse 1, says, "Early in the morning, the chief priest," including probably Annas and Caiaphas, "with the elders and scribes and the whole council, immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate." In Matthew 27, verses 20 through 25, it says, "But the chief priest and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and put Jesus to death. But the governor said to them, 'Which of the two do you want me to release for you?' And they said, 'Barabbas.' Pilate said to them, 'Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?' They all said, 'Crucify him.' And he said, 'Why? What evil has he done?' But they kept shouting all the more, saying, 'Crucify him.' When Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, 'I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves.' And all the people said, 'His blood shall be on us and our children.'" It is extremely interesting that the high priest, at the beginning and end of that generation, were from the family of Annas. I would not be surprised at all to find out in heaven that this incident of the heifer giving birth to a lamb was a thunderbolt out of a clear blue sky to the family of Annas. It was one of those remember the Alamo moments. Remember that guy your grandfather and uncle killed 36 years ago? His blood guilt is on you and your household. It could also be the case that this high priest Matthias, who led that heifer to the sacrifice, had more than just the blood of Jesus imputed against him. Vanderkam and Derenberg have suggested that Matthias was appointed high priest right about the same time the Neronic persecution struck the church in Judea in late 64 AD, implying that this was the very high priest who enforced Nero's persecution in Palestine. If so, it means that he himself had the blood of the martyred Christians on his own head, and that he was one of the brood of vipers whom Jesus had in mind when he said that they would fill up the measure of the guilt of their fathers by killing his disciples in the coming generation. He seems to have been the high priest who literally finished filling up the bowl of wrath that his grandfather and uncle had partially filled 36 years before. Notice what it says in Matthew chapter 23, verses 31 through 39. "So you testify against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to you. How often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you, from now on, you will not see me until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" So it seems that this strange occurrence of a heifer giving birth to a lamb in the temple at Passover exactly 36 years after the crucifixion of Jesus may very well have been a sign from heaven that the Lamb of God, born of Virgin Mary, was indeed the Son of the Most High, judge and avenger of his martyred saints, and was about to come on the clouds of heaven to pour out upon them the bowl of wrath that they themselves had filled to the brim, at which time he would destroy the temple, desolate the land, kill the wicked, and scatter the rest of them among all the nations. But this was not the only strange event that occurred at Passover in AD 66. Moreover, Josephus tells us, at the same festival, Passover in April of 66, the eastern gate of the inner court of the temple, which was of brass and vastly heavy, and had been with difficulty shut by 20 men, and rested upon a basis armed with iron, and had bolts fastened very deep into the firm floor, which was there made of one entire stone, was seen to be opened of its own accord about the sixth hour of the night, midnight. So he again gives us the day and the hour. "Now those that kept watch in the temple came hereupon running to the captain of the temple and told him of it, who then came up there and not without great difficulty was able to shut the gate again. This also appeared to the vulgar to be a very happy prodigy, as if God did thereby open to them the gate of happiness. But the men of learning understood it, that the security of their holy house was dissolved of its own accord, and that the gate was opened for the advantage of their enemies. This signal foreshowed the desolation that was coming upon them." Kornfeld, in his version of Josephus, one of the other translations besides Whiston and Thackeray, Kornfeld comments on this very event. "The gate referred to is the Nicanor Gate, which gave access to the inner court of the temple. It is known that on pilgrimage festivals, the gates of the temple were opened to the people at midnight. The reported extraordinary occurrence, also echoed by Tacitus, is also mentioned in an obscure dissertation on an extra Mishnaic halakha related to omens. And here is the reference that he's talking about here in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Yoma, Folio 39b. It says, "Our rabbis taught, during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the lot for the Lord did not come up in the right hand of the priest, nor did the crimson-colored strap become white, nor did the westernmost light shine, and the doors of the temple would open by themselves, until Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai rebuked them, saying, 'Hekal, Hekal, why wilt thou be the alarmer thyself? I know about thee that thou wilt be destroyed, for Zechariah ben Iddo has already prophesied concerning thee. Open thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars.'" Compare this statement in the Babylonian Talmud with Zechariah 11, verse 1, where it talks about, "O Lebanon, open your doors that the fire may devour." Well, that's giving us a little taste of what was happening in Judea in the year or so before the Jewish war broke out. The signs were beginning to occur, just like Jesus had predicted, indicating that the end was drawing near. The birth pangs were getting more frequent and intense. Josephus and the other historians seemed totally unaware that Jesus had predicted all of these things, and they were simply recording these events as they had been told about them by those who witnessed and experienced those events. It is utterly amazing to see how God used an unbelieving Jew like Josephus to document all these fulfillments without Josephus even having a clue how it would be used later to prove Christianity true. I will never forget the day in my college dormitory when I walked into the room of one of the guys down the hall and saw a strange-looking, oversized book on his shelf next to all of his religious books. It had the word Josephus on its spine. I had never heard of that book before. I asked the guy what it was all about, and he said, and I will never forget his words, he said, "That is the first century Jewish historian who recorded the history of the Jewish war with Rome, in which the temple was destroyed." Well, that's the first time I'd ever heard someone talk about the destruction of the temple like that. I had no clue that there was a Jewish historian who had recorded all that stuff. That instantly aroused my interest. I asked him where I could get a copy of that book, and he told me it was a Christian bookstore right downtown where he got it. I started reading it and underlining it and highlighting it and annotating it in the margin. Man, I was hooked on that book. It was just amazing what it was saying about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD and the temple destruction. That was the beginning of my love affair with Jewish and Christian history. In coming weeks, we're going to be looking at a lot of material from Josephus. If you do not have a copy of his book, this is the time to get it. It's available on our website. You'll want to read what he has to say about all these signs that they saw occurring at that time when the war was just about to break out. I would also recommend getting copies of F.F. Bruce's book, Israel and the Nations, as well as my book, First Century Events. These books will really help you get a handle on all this history in this time. All the predictions of the prophets and the apostles and Jesus were fulfilled. Josephus documents every bit of it. All three of these books are available right there on our website, www.preterist.org. Go to our website and get those three books. Josephus, The Complete Works, Israel and the Nations by F.F. Bruce, and my book, First Century Events. Fascinating stuff. Man, we're going to really be seeing some interesting things happening here in coming weeks as we talk about all this stuff from Josephus. Next week, we're going to be looking at Gessius Florus, the Roman procurator in Judea at this very time, 64 to 66 AD. and all the things that he did to provoke the Jews to go to war. We're going to look at the probable fulfillment of the abomination of desolation, what it was and when it occurred. At this time in late 65 and early 66 was the last chance for the Jewish people to flee from Judea easily and safely. Yet it seems that most of them stayed and got caught up in the war. Well, that's what we'll be looking at next time. If any of our listeners have questions or comments about what we looked at here in this session, don't hesitate to email me. My email address again is preterist1@preterist.org. Thanks so much for listening.
This has been Then and Now with Ed Stevens. We would love to hear from you. Send your email to preterist1@preterist.org. Our website has many great articles, books, and audio video resources. The address is www.preterist.org. This teaching ministry depends on your donations and you share in all the good fruit that we produce. To make a donation or support monthly, simply go to our website, www.preterist.org, or call us at 814-368-6578. Join us again next time for Then and Now, where we study the past to shape a better future.